Bonjour Dominique.
Hi.
I thought we could do this entire episode in French because I've got my interview this week for my French citizenship application.
Oh, that is exciting. Sorry, I thought you'd just gone mad.
No, I've actually spent a large part of the last week like desperately cramming, you know, like the name of every French king in history and all of the regions and the names of all the rivers. It's been quite stressful. Feels like a school exam or something.
Why do you need to know all the French kings? Aren't they like happy that they got rid of them?
It is a republic now. But they do want you to know your history and geography, as well as just, you know, whether you're going to be like a good citizen and contribute to the nation, etc. But I am a bit worried about being asked about names of rivers. So that's what I've been doing. I have been muttering the names of rivers to myself.
Well, if any of the French immigration services are listening to this podcast, then I can guarantee that Katie is a very dedicated, would be a very dedicated French citizen.
Ah, merci beaucoup. What's happening with you? It's election week in the Netherlands. That's exciting.
Yeah, is it?
I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of exciting. At the time of recording, we're still in the midst of voting. But yeah, by the time this episode comes out, you'll all know the results probably, which will be that...
Teflon Mark.
Mark Rutte is still going to be Prime Minister. Yeah, Teflon Mark, or as Ben Coates described him this week in an article, he's the Japanese knotweed of Dutch politics. Impossible to get rid of.
That's a horrible thing to be called.
Yeah, it really is. Anyway, I'm not allowed to vote in it, which is really annoying because I am not Dutch, even though I am an EU citizen. And that, yeah, that's something that's always really annoyed me. And I'm really obsessed with this election and with politics, and I'd really like to vote. So yeah, there's this citizens initiative from Voters Without Borders where they're trying to give EU migrants full political rights in their country of residence. And I support it strongly.
It is a huge thing, isn't it? It's one of the main reasons that I'm becoming French, or trying to become French, is because I would like to vote in the presidential election next year. And municipal elections, and all kinds of elections.
Well, I'm allowed to vote in my municipal elections already because they think, oh yeah.
You care about what day the bins go out.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact that I pay taxes here and have lived here for a long time and kind of speak the language isn't enough, apparently. Anyway. It's not going to be a very exciting election. Probably, famous last words. Yeah, it's probably just going to be a very similar result to the election in 2017. Everyone's desperate for a bit more excitement, I think, which is strange because usually the elections are a bit too exciting here.
I'm looking forward to weeks of coalition forming because that feels like European normality and I would like a dose of that, please.
Weeks? You mean months?
Months even.
Anyway, this week we're not going to be talking about the Dutch election anymore. We're going to be heading to Switzerland, where they had a referendum a few weeks ago, and the public voted with a slim majority to support a proposal banning full face coverings in public. Yeah, after a campaign that leaned pretty heavily on Islamophobia. We're going to be speaking to Inez Elshich, a member of the Purple Scarves, a Swiss Muslim feminist collective that provides support and solidarity to Muslim women who decide to wear headscarves. But first, it's time for... Who has had a good week, Katie?
It's been a good week for dealing with the past, I guess. In that the French government has announced that it is going to speed up the declassification of documents relating to the Algerian War in the 1950s and early 60s.
Sorry, are you giving the French government good week, the week that you're trying to get French citizenship?
Absolutely no link between these two things, if you're listening at the préfecture over there. Anyway, this is one of those things that it's kind of difficult to understand the significance of these documents. Until you get your head around the place that this war has in French history and the scars that it's left, which I will do my best to explain briefly. So the Algerian War was a war of independence. Algeria had been a French colony for 132 years from 1830 onwards. And then in 1954, this horrible, horrible conflict breaks out between Algerian nationalists who want to end colonialism. And on the other side, you've got France, which wanted to hang on to this colony. And this conflict was just horrific. Hundreds of thousands of people died. One of the things that it's most infamous for is the really systematic and brutal use of torture by French troops. So it was awful and traumatic. And it ended in 1962 and Algeria became an independent country. And after that, France just tried to forget this very inglorious conflict. There was this kind of national, willful amnesia almost. Politicians didn't talk about it. It wasn't taught at schools. It wasn't seen as a desirable thing for historians to study. It wasn't even described officially as a war until 1999. People just called it les événements d'Algérie, like the Algerian events. It was just hugely taboo. That has been gradually changing over the last few decades. But even now, historians are still having this surprisingly hard time studying a conflict that finished 60 years ago. And that is because the government passed this law in 2011 that said all of the documents that have a big secret word stamped across the top of them had to be declassified page by page, meaning someone would have to read through page by page and say, yes, this is okay to be made public and it's not going to endanger national security, the fact that it's public. And that was really confusing because there was also, at the same time, another law passed 3 years earlier that said any document, as soon as it's 50 years old, should just become public. Because, you know, what are the risks after 50 years? They should be pretty minimal in terms of like endangering national security because it's like deep history by that point. And the public deserves to know what our government was doing 50 years ago. So these two laws are really contradictory. And for a long time, people working the government archives just ignored the more restrictive law from 2011. And they just carried on releasing documents as soon as they turned 50. But then this slightly shady wing of the Prime Minister's office got involved. It's the National Security Department. And they started saying, no, we are going to enforce this law. And every individual page needs to be individually declassified. And what that has meant in practice is this crazy situation where tens of thousands of documents that were already public got reclassified. So you had historians who had been looking at these documents, which detail the use of torture, for example, by the French in Algeria. And then suddenly they were told, you can't look at these documents, they're secret.
What about like references, secondhand references to those documents?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, there's a bunch of books out already that already reference these documents. It's a really, really weird situation. But the bottom line is the government has made it harder to study this war and to get to the bottom of what happened during this period that France has been kind of keen to forget.
So what are they actually doing now? Are they releasing all of these documents?
Not all at once, but they are going to speed up the process. So what it's going to mean is that they can declassify whole boxes of documents at a time. I mean, these are literally sheets of paper that we're talking about. So it'll be whole boxes of documents at a time rather than individual sheets of paper. So it has been a good week to some extent for the historians, but they're still not actually that happy because what they want is for the documents just to be made public after 50 years.
Yeah.
So it's a step in the right direction, but they're still not getting access to these papers like nearly as quickly as they would like.
So this war was 60 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it being discussed so much now?
So a lot of people see it as part of an effort by Macron to reckon with the Algerian war. He is the first French president born after this conflict. And I think it is fair to say that more than any French president before him, he has been trying to confront the past a bit better. So he has officially recognized the use of torture in a couple of really notorious cases. When he was running for president back in 2017, he went to Algeria and he said that colonization had been a crime against humanity, which felt like a really huge thing to say at the time. More recently, he has asked this really respected historian called Benjamin Stora to write a really big report on the war and come back with some recommendations for how to move past it. And actually fixing this problem of historians not being able to get into the archive, that was one of the recommendations in the report when it came out a few months ago. There are also a couple of other really big recommendations. The report called for a Memories and Truth Commission to be set up to gather people's accounts of what happened. It called for kids to be better educated about the war. What it didn't do, crucially, was ask the government to apologize for the war. Quite a lot of Algerians and French people of Algerian descent would like an apology, but the government has never been keen on that, I guess partly because, you know, that might lead to something like a suggestion that they should pay reparations, among other things. But all of this is to say that I think Macron has done more than previous presidents to talk about what's happened, but the war is still something that people have incredibly strong feelings about.
So we all know there's a presidential election on the horizon in France.
Mm-hmm.
Will Macron talking about Algeria win him any votes?
You know, it's really tricky. It's definitely going to come up in the election campaign because next year, just before the first round of the election, is the 60th anniversary of the end of the war. The thing that's really difficult is that even though France is confronting the history of this war more than it used to, it's still massively divisive. So there are millions of French people who are of Algerian descent, who often feel like France hasn't done nearly enough to make amends for the terrible things it did during the war and for colonial exploitation in general. And, you know, particularly young French Algerians who talk about identity politics a bit more than previous generations. They often talk about how these colonial ideas of Muslims as inferior or definitely other in some way, that is something that hasn't gone away and still contributes to racism and Islamophobia in a massive way. So that part of the population thinks that France needs to have more of a reckoning. On the other side, you have right-wing French voters who don't think that France should be apologizing or even dwelling on this bit of history. And they're sometimes even quite nostalgic for this time when France was a great power with an empire. So it's tricky. It's also worth pointing out Macron is very likely to face Marine Le Pen again in a presidential runoff. And her party was basically built on resentment over Algeria. Its original support base back in the 60s was people who felt that France had been humiliated by this conflict and lost its greatness. So the whole thing is like politically quite explosive in that there's really strong feelings about it on both sides. And I don't think either side is necessarily that happy with what Macron has done. Like either they think he's talking about it too much or they think he hasn't done enough.
It sounds like he's trying to like find a middle way and not being very successful.
Yeah, which is Macron's whole thing, or at least it was in the last election campaign. Neither on the left, neither on the right. We'll see how things look for the next election campaign. But who has had a bad week?
Well, I found a way to get the Eurovision Song Contest into Good Week, Bad Week.
Yay!
Which is probably in everyone's interest, seeing as I found myself trying to convince Katie earlier that I should talk about a vote on a European Parliament Transports Committee. I really need to keep a check on my growing Brussels bubble obsession.
What's happened to you? You used to be cool.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I'm also obsessed with Eurovision, and it's been a bad week for a Belarusian band called Galassi Zmesta after their entry for the Eurovision Song Contest was rejected by the organisers at the European Broadcasting Union. Now, I think that I don't have to explain what Eurovision is anymore. I know we have a lot of American listeners, and Eurovision has sometimes been strangely absent from the American public discourse.
Don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know why either. But there has now been a Will Ferrell Netflix movie about Eurovision. So I hope most people know what I'm talking about. And if not, go and Google country divorced. I also think I probably don't have to remind everyone too much about the situation of democracy in Belarus, which is pretty dire. Following the presidential election in August last year, election was in air quotes, by the way, there were enormous nationwide protests against the questionable re-election of Lukashenko, a man who's been in power since 1994 and was famously described by George Bush as Europe's last dictator.
Thank you for all this slightly patronizing background, Dominic. All of our listeners are extremely up to date with what's going on in Belarus and Eurovision, I'm sure. Get to the point. What's going on with this band from Belarus?
Well, the band, they are Lukashenko supporters. Mm. But I think that in itself would not have been enough to justify exclusion. Bands are allowed to hold whatever views they like. But according to the rules, Eurovision is a non-political event. It says, no lyrics, speeches, gestures of a political, commercial or similar nature shall be permitted during the Eurovision Song Contest or the ESC. Galaxy Zmeta's song is called I'll Teach You. It's sung in Russian. And if I took a passing look at the translation of the lyrics, they could be read in many different ways. But once you look at the text more closely and combine it with what we know about the band, it becomes pretty clear why the European Broadcasting Union judged the song to have a political message.
What kind of things are in the lyrics?
Well, there are these lines which have been read by many as alluding to and supporting the violent crackdown of the police on protesters. For example, I'll teach you how to dance the tune. I'll teach you to take the bait. I'll teach you to walk the line.
That is an unusually threatening sounding Eurovision lyric, isn't it?
It is. Although some supporters say that it's actually about BDSM.
Oh.
And yes, many song lyrics are ambiguous, but the context gives us a pretty clear picture. So yeah, the band publicly support Lukashenko. They've criticized protesters publicly. And if you still have any doubts, let's look back at some of their musical oeuvre. One of their songs is called A Wife's Song and mocks the opposition leader Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. And another is titled The Flautist, mocking another opposition leader, Maria Kolesnikova, a flautist by training, who is still locked up in jail after they tried to expel her from the country and she bravely refused. And just to remind everyone, 33,000 people are said to have been detained during these protests. Some are still locked up in jail. The protests are ongoing, not in the same way as they were over the summer in big city squares, but often in smaller groups in neighborhoods to avoid police crackdowns. And going back to the song, it's important to know that the band was selected by the Belarus state broadcaster, not voted for by the public like has happened in previous years. And the president of the Belarus state broadcaster is actually on the EU sanctions list.
Mm.
The Swedish MEP Karin Carlsberg pointed that out last week and said that the state-owned TV is the propaganda megaphone for this dictatorship. So it would have been pretty controversial if this Lukashenko-supporting song would have been allowed to perform.
But I feel like there have been some political songs at Eurovision, haven't there, previously?
Yes, that's true. There was this song, 1944, which was about the deportation of Crimean Tatars by the Soviet Union, and it drew very clear parallels to the Russian annexation of Crimea, which had happened 2 years earlier. That was not excluded, and in fact, it went on to win.
When strangers are coming, they come to your house, they kill you all and say, we're not guilty.
But the EBU did exclude the Georgian entry in 2009, which was a song that could be interpreted as criticizing Putin following the Five-Day War in 2008. Funnily enough, these all involve Russia.
Interesting.
Some people even argue that Conchita Wurst's winning song from 2014 was political because it had a message of gay liberation.
Peering from the mirror, no, that isn't me. A stranger getting nearer, who can this person be? You wouldn't know me at all today. From the fading light I fly, rise like a phoenix out of the ashes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really buy that because gay liberation is not quite the same as supporting a brutal dictator or talking about a war.
I agree. Non-controversially.
Good.
So what's going to happen now? Are Belarus like completely out of the competition or are they going to put another song in?
Well, the EBU have said that they will need to hear a modified version of the song or a new entry in order to have Belarus in the competition. President Lukashenko actually responded himself the other day, which is pretty extraordinary, saying that they were going to make another song. We'll see about that.
He's got his priorities straight.
There have been calls to allow last year's entry to stand again, as is happening with many others, if not most other European countries, because, of course, last year's competition was cancelled. They're actually a really sweet duo called VAL, or Val, and sadly, it's very unlikely that they'll be allowed to stand for Belarus because the Belarusian broadcaster excluded them due to statements they made in support of the protesters.
Oh.
Which is sad for them and pretty gutting.
So they're also too political.
Yeah.
Bummer.
On the other side, I got quite bummed out researching all of this, but I guess it's only Eurovision. And there are much more depressing things happening in Belarus right now. But yeah, aside from anything else, this song, I'll Teach You, is an absolutely atrocious piece of pop music. I reckon we shouldn't even listen to a clip of it. And I think maybe it could have ended up placed even lower than the UK entry inevitably will be. So for now, it's nul point for Galaxy Smesta.
Can we get to the big question, which is, are we going to endorse Iceland again this year?
Yes.
Okay, that was simple. I don't think the song is as outrageously good as the song they wrote for last year, but it is good.
Yeah, I agree. It's not like as brilliant, but I still loved it. And I think once we see the video and there's some awkward hip swinging dancing, then I think we'll be sold. Have you got another favourite, Katie?
No, and I kind of want to refrain from endorsing Iceland until I've heard all of the entries. So I will be diligently making my way through all of them.
That's very fair of you.
Another week, another large number of generous people to thank for supporting this podcast. Who are we thanking this week, Dominic?
Big thanks to Elena Vokale, Bill Proud, Marijn van Wingerden, Alana O'Hagan, Jola Kusnierz, Sabrina Hessler, Matthew Schwartz, Ivan Nierotti, and Cassia Sinet. Sorry for mispronouncing all of your names.
That's a 100% hit rate.
Please don't cancel.
Well done. We are a very small operation, and we're very proud that we're a very small operation and that we've managed to make this podcast what it is without the backing of a massive media organization. But we can't do it without you. So, you know, if you're strapped for cash right now, that is totally understandable. And there are lots of different ways to support what we're doing, like getting your grandma to listen. But if you do have a few euros or pounds or dollars a month to spare, we would absolutely love it if you could join this lovely community supporting this podcast and come and hang out with us on the internet. You can find out more at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Let's go to Switzerland to speak to Ines Elscher. You probably saw in the headlines a couple of weeks back that Switzerland has voted in a referendum to ban, well, really to ban Muslim women from wearing the burqa or the niqab in public spaces. It isn't the first European country to introduce this kind of a ban. Islamic veils that cover the face are also fully or partially banned here in France, as well as over there where you are in the Netherlands, Dominic, as well as Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, and Denmark. In Switzerland, as in other places, you know, there's been a lot of heated debate over whether this is necessary, whether this is Islamophobic. And in the end, Swiss voters came out in support of the ban in a referendum on March the 7th. A very narrow yes vote, as Dominic said, just over 51%. And there's a lot going on here, but we really want to understand the context a little bit better. And we also really want to know what this very difficult public debate has felt like for Muslim women in Switzerland. So we thought we would give Ines a call. She is a member of the Foulard Violet, or the Purple Headscarves. They're a feminist group who speak up for Muslim women. And she just talks about this whole thing super articulately. I learned lots from speaking to her, and I hope that you do too. Maybe we should start with the very basics. There's a few different words for different headscarves that get bandied around in the press a lot. Hijab, burqa, niqab. Could you maybe just explain the differences for us?
Yes, there are several different ways for women who want to wear Muslim attire to do so. The most known and the most common one is the hijab, which is a headscarf that shows the full face and covers the hair. Then you have a more covering attire called the jilbab, who shows the face but is longer than the hijab, covers the full body, letting the face open. Then you have the ones that cover actually the face. The most common one is the niqab, showing the eyes and covering the lower part of the face. And this is actually the face veil that we see here in Europe. And there is the burqa, which is actually face veil that covers totally the face with a more transparent area around the eyes that lets the possibility of the person seeing from the outside but not being seen. And this is worn in Afghanistan. It's like a very specific to this region. The word burqa is generally used as an umbrella term for many face veils here in Europe, but actually they're all different. There are so many different face veils that are so specific to regions, and not only to Muslim regions. There are so many cultures in the world that actually know in their traditional attire some form or other of full face cover. But in Middle East, that is the niqab, that shows the eyes. It's the one that we are most familiar to.
Last week's referendum was only about full face coverings.
Yes.
How often do you actually see women with full face coverings in Switzerland?
There has been studies that were made by the University of Lucerne about the prevalence of full face covering in Switzerland. And actually, it's estimated that from about 20 to 30 women in whole Switzerland wear it. So you have to be aware of how small of a number it is. 30 people represents 0.00035% of Swiss population.
Okay, so given that basically no one wears this thing, what, in your opinion, was actually going on with this vote?
This vote was launched by the nationalist Swiss party, so-called People's Party, which is a xenophobic, far-right and Islamophobic anti-Muslim party that has, in the last decade, launched in many occasions initiatives and votes, referendums, targeting specifically migrants, Muslims and other communities in Switzerland. And specifically, this party launched 10 years ago the ban on minarets, because now when, for example, you have a mosque, they are not allowed to have a minaret, which is very discriminatory because it's the only kind of religious building that is not allowed to be visible from the outside. You have to understand these tactics as constant stigmatization of Muslim population in Switzerland. What is aimed here is to always and constantly stigmatize Muslim people in Switzerland, always presenting them in a problematic light and fueling Islamophobia. Now, you have also to understand the context of Swiss politics, where we have here direct democracy system, meaning that the people of Switzerland get to vote very regularly on topics that are proposed by political parties. And more specifically, in political science, it has been shown that actual policies are easier to enforce and to be accepted by people if they go by small steps. And this is something that has been very prevalent in the strategies of the nationalist party. So, for example, now they passed the burqa ban. The next step is going to the regular headscarf ban in some spaces, such as schools. And then from there on, to reach, you know, that discriminatory regime that they are aiming for.
You are part of a feminist collective that supports Muslim women who decide to wear the headscarf. And as you say, that is, you're expecting that to be the next political debate. I think maybe for some non-Muslims who don't know much about it, they might think the words headscarves and feminism wouldn't be the most obvious match. I was wondering if you could help explain this synergy to people who perhaps don't understand it.
I think that as feminists, what we aim for is the right of self-determination and the right for every woman to choose whatever empowers her in her specific position. So now it means that as a feminist, I'm not in favor of the headscarf or against the headscarf. I'm not in favor of the burqa or against the burqa. I'm just in favor of self-determination and against coercition. Coercition can take many forms. It can take the form of forcing a woman to wear an attire or forcing her to not wear it. This debate of whether some particular attire can subject women to some form of discrimination or some form of patriarchal values, it can be actually the case for any attire women can wear. For example, we can open the debate about wearing a lipstick, wearing high heels, wearing a skirt. But we are very aware that while every single piece of cloth that we put on our bodies are generally gendered and have a long history behind it, only the fact of being able to choose whatever we want to do with our bodies is liberating per se.
I was quite interested to see that in French-speaking Switzerland, there wasn't a very strong no vote there, which is maybe a bit surprising because French-speaking Switzerland is usually a bit more left-wing, and it was mostly, as you say, conservatives that were driving this referendum. There is this kind of tendency in French feminism to see Muslim women as poor victims that need to be rescued, sometimes in a kind of patronizing kind of way. Is that what was going on there in these French-speaking regions? Was it feminists thinking these women are oppressed and this is the right thing to do?
Yes, totally. In French-speaking part of Switzerland, we have a high influence of the French debates and the way it's conducted. And actually, France is now very aggressive towards the appearance of Muslim women. For example, Muslim women in France with a headscarf cannot attend schools. They cannot, for example, accompany children at school travels. They cannot work as nannies. So many things are very specifically targeted towards Muslim women in France. In some way, you can say that it polluted the Swiss debate in the French-speaking part. So, for example, they would talk a lot about what is secularism, while this burqa ban has nothing to do with secularism per se. It just has to do with who has the right to be in the public space. Moreover, French feminist organizations very noticeably have not yet embraced in the mainstream forms support for Muslim women. There has been numerous events such as Muslim women pushed out of 8th of March protests, prominent feminists in France speaking against women wearing headscarf, prominent feminists saying that when a Muslim woman is attacked, she's not attacked as a woman, she's attacked as a Muslim, so it's not of any concern for feminists. These kind of things that happen a lot in France. So when we started campaigning in Switzerland, and we, of course, we are French speaking, and we were presenting ourselves as Muslim feminist people, the people would tell us, but is that even possible? And the preconception here is that Muslim women, and this is a very racist and patronizing view, are not able to determine what they want. So when they claim, for example, wanting to wear a headscarf or wanting to be free and considered equal to other women, they always have this assumption that there are Muslim men behind us who are telling us what to say, telling us what to do, as if we are children who never grew up and who are never able to understand issues like any other women in feminist movements.
One of our listeners in Switzerland sent us a map of how different areas voted. And it's really interesting to see that, broadly speaking, you know, people in cities were much more likely to vote against the ban, and people in the countryside, where there aren't many Muslims, were much more likely to vote for it. And it kind of reminded me of Britain before the Brexit vote. There were all of these surveys showing that people in rural areas were much more likely to feel like the country was changing in ways that they didn't recognise and they felt threatened culturally in some way. Is that the same kind of phenomenon going on here, do you think?
Yes, totally. I think that what is very interesting is that people who are truly living within multicultural settings with, you know, in urban areas where they actually meet Muslim people are less likely to support the Islamophobic policies. What's interesting is that, for example, in Switzerland, you have this multi-level democracy. You can vote on the local level and on the national level. Before voting on the national level, there are two regions in Switzerland who were voted in favor of the burqa ban. And it was in two small cantons, in two small regions, where there are almost no Muslim people. They voted them around 2014 and 2016. Noticeably, one of them, since the voting, there was not a single one Muslim woman who was fined because of wearing a burqa, simply because there was never an occurrence of a Muslim woman being there. So just that tells you about how, you know, extremist policies are built upon fantasies. They use fantasies of what is a Muslim person to build this image of Switzerland being invaded. This tendency of the Nationalist Party to build an imaginary threat and to sell it to people as if their way of life is changing, but actually it's not. And of course, this lies is much harder to sell to people living in cities where there are actual cultural diversity and where they can have neighbors being Muslim or work colleagues. Or you see, it's much harder to impose this kind of fantasies on people who are actually living the real reality of living with Muslim people.
Unfortunately, your side lost in the referendum last week. And I was wondering, how do you feel and how are you guys picking yourselves up and carrying on fighting?
We won more than we lost. Actually, when we entered the campaign a few months ago, the forecast was overwhelming majority of the people in Switzerland accepting the burqa ban, almost 70% of votes accepting it. And when we entered the campaign, we were able to mobilize a large portion of the civil society, many feminist organizations, many anti-racist organizations, up to the point that when the vote actually occurred, it was won only by a very short majority, actually by 51.2% of the votes, knowing that 3 months ago, the polling were showing almost 70%. Yes, we lost this battle, but we didn't lose on the long term, because what we built here, a strong coalition of feminist movement in favor of the fight against Islamophobia is something that is, to be honest, unseen in the history of Europe. Never you will find in Europe an occurrence of the mainstream feminist movement taking a strong stance against Islamophobia like we did here. And we showed that actually the coalition between feminists is a major political force today in Western Europe.
Thank you so much to Inez for joining us. And thank you also to the several listeners in our Patreon group on Facebook who mentioned that they would be interested in hearing more about the Swiss burqa ban on the podcast. We always love hearing from you about what you want us to cover, mostly because it means less work for us, but also because it makes for a more interesting show in general. So if there is something happening in your corner of Europe or somewhere else in Europe that you think needs to be on our radar, drop us an email, hello@europeanspodcast.com. What have you been watching this week?
Well, last week marked a year, extraordinarily, since theatres had to shut down in much of Europe and beyond. Yeah, and many theatres have been closed since then, which is the longest shutdown of theatres in modern history.
It's crazy.
To mark this anniversary, dozens of theatres across the world hosted and live-streamed performances of the same play last Saturday. On the 13th of March. It's a play called White Rabbit, Red Rabbit by the Iranian writer Nassim Soleimanpour. And it's a really interesting concept. It's a play that's devised to be performed by one single actor on a stage with a chair, a table and a ladder, requiring no rehearsal and no director. It begins with the actor on stage being handed an envelope which contains their script that they've never seen before.
Fun!
Yeah, and they begin reading it right away and the play begins. It's really difficult to describe, but the play was written by Soleimanpour from Iran, where he at the time didn't have a passport because he hadn't done military service. So he wasn't able to leave the country at that point. And it's a piece about freedom, censorship, and transcending national boundaries. And each actor is only allowed to perform it once and isn't allowed to do any research in advance of the play. There were 40 theatres in the Netherlands alone that performed it simultaneously. I watched one from Veldhoven. But it was also streamed from Minsk to New York to Panama City, all over the place. Not exactly a recommendation because you've all missed it now, sorry. But I wanted to talk about it anyway and recommend that you look out for it next time it comes up.
Nice.
Because it was really quite affecting. What have you enjoyed this week?
I watched a lovely Georgian film over the weekend. It's called And Then We Danced. Have you seen it?
No. Tell me about it.
It's maybe the most this podcast film ever. In that it is a gay Georgian dance movie.
Oh.
It's really, really good. It's about a group of trainee dancers at the National Georgian Ensemble. They do traditional Georgian dancing, which I have to confess I've never seen before. And I didn't realize it involved quite so much like slamming of knees into the floor if you're a man.
Oh, ouch.
It looks really painful to perform, but it's very beautiful to watch. And the film follows this young guy called Merab falling for another guy, one of his classmates, in this very gender normative world of traditional dance in Georgia. And I thought it was a really powerful film. It was super controversial when it came out, actually, a couple of years ago. The Georgian far right organized protests against it, which was horrible. But it's just a lovely film about somebody working out who they are. And the music is really beautiful. Also, generally, I really enjoy dance movies because it's just something that I can't do. And I just sit there on the sofa, like usually stuffing my face with chocolate and like marveling at the athleticism on the screen. But yeah, I really recommend this movie. It has deservedly won a bunch of prizes at film festivals over the last couple of years. And it manages to not be too despairing, I think. It's really nice.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it now in a few years ago. I want to watch it. Is it? Where did you find it?
It is available on a range of different streaming websites.
Thank you.
So check it out. I'm not going to favour one or the other. Also, very quickly, I just went to pick up the post and there was the loveliest thing in there from our friends at Are We Europe magazine. A bunch of recipe cards from different diaspora communities in Europe. Did you get these too or was it just me?
I did. Yeah, they are so lovely. Mine were hand delivered.
Oh.
And yeah, I just thought it was the nicest thing to get through the post.
That's super nice. There's like loads of different ones. I'm just flicking through. I think I might make a Bisara this weekend, which was sent in by Lubna Kalkali. It's a colourful crisscross between a dip and a soup, and it's the perfect remedy for your winter blues. Moroccan recipe. There you go.
This week's happy ending is another story of someone finding something incredibly valuable in their home. Except there's a twist this time. This time the person wasn't so happy to have it discovered. It all started when Dario Del Bufalo, an Italian expert on ancient marbles, was at his book signing in Manhattan, New York, a few years ago, when someone in the queue was leafing through the book and they saw the picture of a 2,000-year-old mosaic made of striking red porphyry and green and white glass and marble. And the person said, "Hey, that's Helen's coffee table."
What?
And that person wasn't the only one who recognized it during the book signing. Helen's coffee table was apparently quite the talk of the town. It had even been photographed before in Architectural Digest, but no one had realized that Helen's coffee table was in fact a long-lost mosaic that had been aboard Roman Emperor Caligula's floating palace in Lake Nemi.
Eh? How does that get turned into a coffee table?
Well, it's like a tile, essentially, a tile of mosaic that I guess they just added legs to, and she would put her tea and coffee on it.
Wow. My coffee table's made out of a bit of flooring, but I'm pretty sure it's not ancient.
Well, it's pretty much the same thing. Anyway, your coffee table probably wasn't aboard Caligula's floating palace or orgy boat, as the Daily Beast gleefully describes it.
Orgy boat.
Yeah, I mean, it's no one really knows what happened on this boat, but it's been suggested that it's where he had, like, perverted sex parties. But I think it's, from what I read in the New York Times, like, it's all total speculation.
Sorry to digress for a second, but like, I can't imagine anything worse than having an orgy on a boat, because I get so seasick. It'd be so deeply unsexy.
Okay, good to know, Katie.
Moving on.
Anyway, this is a happy ending because the mosaic is now back in Italy in a new naval museum after restorers spent some years working on it, trying to get the tea and coffee stains out of Helen's much-loved table.
No!
The mosaic was actually seized by the American police and returned to Italy after an investigation by Italy's Special Art Crime Squad. Helen, an art and antiquities dealer, and her Italian-American journalist husband have not been charged with any crimes, and they say they bought it in good faith, but they couldn't prove that it had been imported legally to the US, and therefore it was taken away from them. So truly not a happy ending for them, who have lost their table, which was the talk of the town, but a happy ending for the people of Italy, who can now see this beautiful piece amongst many other naval artifacts.
Do you think Helen and her husband have just gone to IKEA and replaced it with a really sad $20 one?
Probably. Tragic.
Right, I have to go and memorize key dates of the French Revolution. So we'll be back next week, hopefully one step closer to being French. On this end of the call, at least. In the meantime, you can find us on all of your favorite social media platforms. Except TikTok. We have yet to take the TikTok plunge, but we're on all the others. Come and find us on Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram at Europeans Podcast, and we're on Facebook under the Europeans Podcast.
I actually did an audition on TikTok this week.
Ah, so cool and modern.
That's a story for another time.
We'll hear about that next week. Thank you so much to our editors, Katz Laszlo, Andrei Popovicu, and Priyanka Shankar.
Bye, everyone.
À la prochaine.
Ce French.